Stocks and bonds both went up today. Otherwise, it was a pretty boring day. It's Tuesday, May 7th, 2024. This is Overtime. I'm your host, Chris Vecchio, the man in orange, Ilya Spivak, the man in blue, Dylan Radigan. We're here to take you through the next hour as we wrap up this futures markets close. Gentlemen, it wasn't a big day of data releases, nor for earnings, although Disney got shellacked. Ultimately, this market continues to watch what's happening with recalibrating Fed cut odds, the ongoing tug and pull in oil prices, and perhaps natural gas as well. All eyes on the Japanese yen, which for another day continues to outpace everyone else to the downside. But gentlemen, today was a day where I have a hard time saying that there's much conviction on either side of this market and really anything. It's not like there was one outlier where you saw a 3 or 4 or 5% move. This was quiet all around. S&P 500, 52, 13.75. Technically, that is a gain, and it's a gain of 0.15%. Volatility comes in a little bit. Stocks climb up a tiny bit themselves. NASDAQ, 0.07% gainer here, 18,199.5. Ilya, I'll start with you because Dylan already declared his allegiance to the truth, justice, and American way of life side of the markets. So today you were thinking about
annoyed. Cutting the cord. Yeah, I was annoyed.
You were annoyed because yesterday your game plan was, okay, let's see how this market opens and trades. And
yes,
depending upon the open, I'm going to probably cut the cord. But in last call, you just mentioned that you were annoyed because this is a market that didn't give you that final piece of evidence to get you to bail. And yet
it stopped.
You're still close to bailing.
Yes. I mean, it basically left me scratching my head again, because if the question was, will we follow through? And I think the version of this on the NASDAQ really makes perfect work of this, because it really shows where the line in the sand is for the series of lower highs and lower lows in this move. It ultimately didn't get through. It stopped and left a sort of indecision candle. Now, what's interesting is if you, and this is by no means anything I would say is telling of anything necessarily, but if you look at what this amounts to as a correction, the most recent rally we've had is a 100% extension of the preceding step higher. So you get the first step higher, a pullback, and then a perfectly equidistant step higher. And then you run into the resistance right there. Does that mean that this thing is exhausted? Who knows? But this is frustrating, because I would have rather taken my loss already if this finally sort of made up its mind, freed up some capital and looked elsewhere. But rules are rules, and so far it does not want to comply. Now, we'll see how this goes, because actually the makings of a bearish argument, I think, are pretty good here, and we can have that conversation. But the price action is everything, and if the market doesn't see those makings, then I'm not going to fight it.
Yeah, you mentioned that the market swung up to the 100% level from the swings off the lows. Also, the descending trend line from the highs that you have in March and in April come in closer to 18,275. Mm-hmm. We talked about that yesterday. We encroach upon it today. We get to 18,263 before we ultimately pull back in some. The end of the day here, we get the jiggle to the market where we fade off and then we bounce a little bit more. You know what? As a bull, we're closing higher than we did yesterday.
Yeah.
Right. And if yesterday,
you can't argue with that.
Right. If Friday you're coming out of the market feeling better, and yesterday we break all these considerable, you know, these EMA clouds that have been very instrumental for the market uptrend over the past several months. The fact that we're still on the other side of them, okay, pull back off the high. So what? But it's not exactly what you say. Like, is it the most encouraging kind of day price action wise? No. But Dylan, this is the whole, as you were joking about in the show beforehand, you know, good time to just pop open a glass of scotch and sit and wait and sit on your hands and wait, because everything is kind of slowly coming together. Now, if the people at the bar next to you want to talk, that's fine, but sitting and waiting may be the prudent thing to do.
Take it easy. Just sip on your glass. Don't pop open a new bottle. You don't have to leave the bar. Just calm down. It's okay. You're allowed to have some days where nothing happens. That's the key to an adult existence. This isn't some sort of pleasure dome. Okay. You got to relax. Sometimes it's boring. I don't know what to tell you.
It's the S&P 500, not Bohemian Grove, Dylan. Yeah. Right? Everyone calm down.
Although, again, that's what I'm saying. If you were looking, you know, change the channel if you're looking for a little more stimulation. Sometimes you got to calm down. I did buy that silver, though. Didn't do much of anything, but I got in there. I actually thought today was a lovely day to originate both on the NASDAQ. I like the fact that nothing happened because I needed some time to I was busy today. So I came in late in the day and was like, oh, great. Nothing happened. I didn't miss anything.
One interesting thing that happened on your silver here is we got Chinese FX reserve numbers that came out overnight. Oh. And of course, we know that the main catalyst here, or at least the going theory for precious metals, sure, is Chinese reserve buying.
Yep.
And it slowed to almost nothing. So it's been surging. And in this particular go round, they've basically stopped. This is the smallest.
How do you interpret that relative to the narrative?
Well, this is an interesting point here then, because this was the weakest uptake that they've reported on the gold side now in 18 months. Now, this is maybe because gold has rallied a lot and now they have a little bit of sticker shock and they're going to back up and then they'll resume accumulating at lower levels. Who's to say? But it's not like the BOC makes a point of announcing its intentions for reserve management. So we'll see what this is.
Strong suit.
Yeah. We'll see what this is.
How much of your silver opinion, Chris, is based on the Chinese narrative?
It's a nice story to tell myself. Like I think I was joking with Jamal earlier. You know, now that I'm back in the precious metals market, not that I think this way ever at all, but now I'm doing things like what's the year-over-year change in the M2 money supply? In reality, I just like the chart. There's no thinking. It's like that fin twit mean, right? Like I don't need to pretend that it's some deficit spending or inflation idea. The chart just broke out of a multi-decade, because it's more than 10 years, multi-decade downtrend. That's it.
Silver.
I like being long. Yeah, silver. I like being long something that's breaking out of a multi-decade downtrend.
So I would, that sounds like something Ilya might say.
I mean, yeah.
He's trying to goad you into the position with us, Ilya.
I mean, there's no way I'm gonna be buying any silver here while it's testing the top of a range that's held for the better part of 4 years. Take me on the other side of that range, and then we'll talk about buying some silver. But the risk reward here, in my mind, isn't anything I'm enthused about.
Well, it is a nice little bounce. I mean, even today, you know, we move lower, but one thing that I did notice over the course of the session, where did we not cross? We didn't get below the 1 month moving average. And vol continues to come in 36.2. I've done the whole spiel about why IVRs and gold and silver are incredibly misleading. Gold and silver vol over the past year have been historically depressed. And so the IVR scale to the past year don't tell the full truth about what has been, what is a really low level when you go back, say, 10 or 15 or 20 years for volatility in these markets. So vol is still cheap, all things considered. I had no reason to change any position adjustment here in silver, Dylan, but I like that you're on board. Gives me more conviction. Certainly gives me more conviction.
But I shouldn't do that. That's a terrible idea. I'm only doing it because I'm with you.
Yeah, but you know what? You've had an eye for the commodities.
This is how bubbles work.
Yeah,
this is exactly how bubbles work.
One of my favorite stories to be, it's a slow day, so I'll tell it. He talks about like his personal history buying, like he just jokes about how whatever, we were talking about small investments in startups and private companies and whatever. And it was some startup in Chicago and come to Chicago and or came to Tom and said, you know, we'll do this, this, and this, whatever the list of things they do is, and the team and the big story, whatever. And then they said, oh, well, you know, this other important, this other like well-known high status Chicago investor has already invested in our company. And so Tom, as he tells the story, says, well, if the other Mr. Big is invested, I'm in. And then later at like a social event or something, months later, he saw the other Mr. Big and he said, oh, well, I invested in XYZ startup because you invested in it. And then the Mr. Big was like, he's like, hang on, the kid told me that I invested because you invested in it. And neither one of them had done any due diligence other than the fact that the startup founder had played them, triangulated them into both. Which
where the hell were these guys when I was looking for seed money for my startups?
So the Ilya thesis of bubble building is underway. Now the silver bubble is underway. We have 66% of the available overtime panel.
This sounds like one of those little subheadings in a good markets history book. The silver bubble of 2024.
I say, you know what?
Financial podcast. Mm-hmm.
Well, it makes sense. You know, Herbert Hunt passed away last week. One of the Hunt brothers who tried to corner the silver market in the late 70s, early 1980s. That culminated in March 1980. So Dylan, maybe his spirit has passed on to us here at Overtime.
Doesn't silver have some more of a use case than gold anyway?
It's 50% industrial use, whereas gold is only about 6%.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a legitimate, you know, gold is the hocus pocus. The silver is a legitimate commodity.
It is.
More so,
right. The question is then how come it's not sitting at all-time highs, whereas gold already is? And this is where you get the people. When you go into the silver bull rabbit hole, you find yourselves talking about J.P. Morgan or listening to stories about J.P. Morgan manipulating the paper silver market. And you're like, that doesn't make any sense. But then again, why is it silver at all-time highs?
Appropriately enough, I'm actually finishing Ron Chernow's profile of the House of Morgan right now. I'm sort of rounding out the end of it. And there's definitely lots and lots of talk of cornering the silver market.
As a reasonable person tries to do over the course of one's life, right? Who hasn't tried to corner the silver market now and again? One market
is
that
there, can't be... Any, speaking of, it's a slow day, is there even a market that's cornerable these days other than the pink, other than some super illiquid small caps? No,
well, I think you'd have to be incredibly illiquid. Incredibly illiquid at this point.
Well, hold on. I think you can make the case that we saw this play out in nickel in the last year or two, right? You had that the big accumulation of that Chinese buyer, if I'm thinking about this correctly. And when he got margin called out, it forced the London Nickel Exchange to reset everyone's trades because they're like, there's just not enough adequate capital out there to cover everyone's losses. So instead of blowing up the entire financial system, let's just pretend yesterday never happened. So they've rolled back everyone's trades. So I think there was an attempted cornering in the nickel market recently within the past year or two. I may have my facts wrong.
But
real, to it's our difficult point, now.
To our point though, right? Nickel, not the most liquid tradable thing.
Right.
Right. There's not a whole lot of back and forth liquidity in nickel.
Right. I mean, I suppose in theory, because there's also position size limits, I suppose in theory, if you have like an oligopolistic group of people who were conspiring in cigar smoke filled rooms to say like, okay, if each of us do all the work in tandem and coordinate together, then we could accumulate enough of a position to effectively corner the market. I don't think any one individual could do it at any commodity today. Even if they tried, you'd have to do it through multiple accounts. And I mean,
that's not the hardest thing in the world.
No, but then that's conspiracy to manipulate the market. So,
well, of course, the whole thing is illegal.
Yeah, that, which is it. Which makes sure
even the, I don't even know whether the market, the point is that I don't even know the market can be cornered, right?
No, nor is it anything that we're recommending. We're not recommending people go out there and try to corner the silver market. This is very much becoming like an intro to Always Sunny in Philadelphia. It's like the gang tries to corner the silver market.
It's a slow day. Anyway, I'll let you put this show back on the rails. I apologize.
Off the rails is a pretty good place for today.
That's what I'm saying. Like, if there's ever a day to talk about cornering the silver market, I just don't know that it can be done. I knew a group of traders at a firm that shall remain nameless that had figured out that if they put, they had it in their head that if they had enough, they had whatever the ratio, the number of bets was and the bet sizing was, if they went to some dog track in Florida with like a couple million dollars, that they could basically guarantee that they would win money. And it worked.
Until?
You know how these things end. Even when you make the money, if you make the money with that, the money's going to get spent on racing motorcycles and cocaine and motors and, you know, things, the money will go away. It'll go away. So, but anyway, we're trying to do much more disciplined and rational actions here. Look at the crude oils. There you go. That's fun.
Yeah. We use the money, really go not anywhere. For motorcycles.
What's that, Ilya?
That one didn't really go anywhere either today. And I'm short it at this point.
Are you?
As of Friday.
I liked our Condor discussion. From yesterday, the Condor that you can, the convertible Condor.
Yeah, I made a small position adjustment. I got out of MCL M4 and rolled it over into MCL N4 last night, just because we were 21 days to expiration. And as contract liquidity thins out, just in case, give yourself more time. In any event, MCL N4 is now trading at 7806. So that didn't work out horribly today for me. Just given the timing of when I got the roll in. Otherwise, yeah, Dylan, I mean, 21 IVR, if you look to the N4 contract, we'll go over to CL in a second. It's 86 high. We'll call it 70 low. What would that look like here? On the trade tab, we go out 38 days, we'll call it. 70.69 is below the lower band of the expected move, which is interesting. And then 85.86, just going to put us in the neighborhood of 71% probability of profit. Max profit 190, max loss 810. Risking four to make one. Let's see if we can get some improvement in there.
I don't really like that.
No, I'm not crazy about that either. But you know, if you pull it up to 70,
yes, nice percentages.
Yeah, just clip them a little bit more inside the expected move, right? Get 62%. This is 270 against 730 in 38 days to expiration. I like this, and I think the crude oil prices are going to continue to fall, but do I think they're going to fall outside of their high-low range of the past 8 months in the next 38 days? Probably not. So I'm going to take this one with you. We're going to do the... Maybe this gets filled before the end of the day. If not, then we'll try to put it on first thing when the market opens. But hopefully this isn't one of those situations where it's like nothing's happening, so let's find a trade, and we end up over-trading. There we go. So that's filled. That's nice. So still holding the short MCLN4 and also putting on the Condor here, because I think this is biased to the downside still, but I don't think the high or lows are going to get knocked out.
I like it.
It's not a great trade. I wish the IVR was 61 instead of 21, but
sure.
You got to take what you can get in these markets on a day like this.
It is definitely slim pickings if you wanted to look for something that's actually going on, but in the currency space, something might be. The British pound is on the move here, interestingly. When everything else was kind of sitting, the pound seems to have, at the very near term, range started to kind of come undone a little. And this is interesting because we saw this begin with the Aussie dollar yesterday. I was writing about the week in macro risk and how it's kind of dead. The two things that had some degree of interest were policy announcements from the RBA, that was yesterday, and the Bank of England, which is on Thursday. What's interesting for both is that they were both looking like they were going to be more dovish than the markets were expecting. With the RBA, that certainly seemed to be the case, and the Aussie got knocked. The next one is this Bank of England one, and the setup looks probably even more acutely vulnerable because the situation with inflation in the UK looks a lot better than Australia. It's disinflating more evenly and faster. So this could be another one of these, and the pound pointedly hasn't been able to make any hay of attempts on the upside. You can see that massive wick there last week after NFP, where it couldn't do anything even with that data. And now it seems to be starting to roll over. So this could be an interesting opportunity here.
Meaning to get short now.
To get short. I got a little short.
Yeah, I actually didn't look at this chart today. And seeing here now the downtrend from the March, April swing highs that we intersected here at the start of May, we started to break through them at the start of May.
Yeah.
And in fact, we've actually rolled over and we've lost the uptrend from the lows that we had at April 21st, May 2nd. We're also breaking back below the area right around 125 that has been instrumental support in the 6 p.m. 4 contract for a long time, going back 6 months. And so the failure to climb through this former zone of support turn resistance makes me think that this thing wants to keel over as well. It, you know, even with U.S. yields turning down, the fact that the pound is still weakening says
it's very telling.
Is this just Brexit gone bad, more Brexit gone bad? Or is this
the situation in Europe has been that their inflation spike is fundamentally different than the U.S. or, for that matter, the Australian inflation spike. In Europe, as it is in Japan, it was more so about imported inflation, the global price of food, the global price of energy. But the underlying inflation that would come with a strong economy, it's not there. And so once these kind of the transitory part of it, if you will, once that goes away, and that's been happening in Europe, last year it was all about energy or food. The year before that, it was all about energy. All that's gone, basically, at this point. Mm-hmm. There's no reason not to cut. Whereas the situation in the U.S. is the labor market has been strong. Inflation is stuck in services. Australia, by the way, the same thing.
But why does that make the pound?
Because they're much likelier to cut. They're much likelier to sound more.
You're just saying rate differentials across the board.
Yeah, I see.
I mean,
they're much likelier to cut more and sooner.
Do you think the pound is ultimately converging to? Do you think dollar, pound, euro are all sort of heading in their own way to parity?
I don't know about the pound. I think there's a lot of structural reasons why the pound should be about above parity. I think euro might be going to parity though. Eventually.
I hope not right now. Still holding the short puts.
Not tomorrow, to be sure. Maybe not this year.
Not within this 45 to 21 DTE cycle. Ilya, no. I just put in an order here. IVR in the pound is negative 4.9. So if you're trying to play this bearish selling calls right now, you're not going to get a lot of juice.
I just sold the future. The micro... the micro
M6B, future. M6B.
I mean the margins are not very high at all if you compare them to like selling the straight MES or MNQ. I mean, those margins are off the charts. Their verticals to me are much more capital efficient, but for the currencies, the margins are relatively small compared to indices, and so I just am selling the future itself. Micro, obviously, M6B.
Given the fact that volatility is on the floor, puts look pretty cheap.
They do.
So have an order in here for a long 1.265 put, short the 126, put 31 days to expiration. Maybe we get a little bit of a sell-off on the Bank of England and a vol expansion on Thursday. The risk is fairly well defined right now, looking at the same confines in the market. Max loss of 218.75, max profit of 93.75. That's not great, not terrible, but it's a small trade for this week because we're at 31 days to expiration as is. And quite frankly, if you look at the currencies that are failing to hold up, the yen obviously is a prime place, but the pound also looks terrible. You've seen the euro has been a little bit more resilient, but the pound, the yen, these are the two that have been really struggling more so than anything else. Ilya, the yen here, another day goes by, Japanese holiday or not, who cares? What matters is the market's challenging the BOJ and Ministry of Finance again. Today's a day where oil prices, ultimately, they go down a little bit. And U.S. yields, they go down a little bit. That should be good for the yen. And yet the yen is not strengthening.
No. No, I think we're seeing here that the intervention has kind of been, it's sort of run its course. And now we see if there is follow through. It seems like we're in this kind of digestive mode now. And we're going to see if we're prepared to actually have this market take on some sort of momentum of its own. Because obviously the BOJ can't be out here every day giving it a nudge. It needs to be impactful enough that the market takes the baton and runs with it. And at this point, okay, so we've had a couple days of digestion, but if we can't find some amount of at least a two-way action, at least a sideways consolidation, then you're going to have serious questions about how long can the BOJ pretend like they're having an effect.
I don't know if it's time to do the intervention trade or put it back on yet. We clearly have seen a line drawn in the sand near the dollar yen spot rate of 160.40, the 1990 high.
Yeah.
In the exchange rate. And when we got to 160.22 in the spot market, that's where we hit the low on the 6J M4 contract on April 28th at 0062.875. So let's just call that as the equivalent right now. It feels like if you get any more weakness into 64, I mean, at 65 and 5.5, I'd like to see another 100 pips or so, because where did we really bottom out prior to those interventions? It's when we got into right below 64, the BOJ and Ministry of Finance started to sniff around. I would be curious to see, though, Ilya, when they intervened, it's 0062.875. The second time when they intervened, we're well north of that. So it feels like if the BOJ and Ministry of Finance, what they're trying to effectuate here is like they know the market's going to come back and challenge them. They're kind of stopping the market in their tracks a little bit sooner each occasion. So maybe we don't go below 64. Maybe once we get down below 64.5, the BOJ tries to step in again, just so that they show the market, like, we're not going to let you test our boundary anymore. Really just disincentivize people in the short term. But this test is going to keep coming. If you're playing the yen on the long side, if you get your intervention, take it off the table immediately. Expect very little follow through.
Yeah.
Even this last one, fading off again, about half the move is completely gone from what we saw on May 1st.
Yeah, it's not yet showing signs that the markets are prepared to essentially say, okay, fine, we'll back away. It is on the dividing line. So if you look at the first intervention and the place where it stopped, and then you look at the second one, you're basically right there. You're at the dividing line. And so if the market essentially says, all right, fine. So you wanted it here with the first intervention, and then you had to make your point again. But this is where you wanted it. Fine. And the market recedes there, and we see consolidation, as we've seen for extended periods in this. I mean, take a look at just the chart you were staring at now. There's whole long stretches of just sideways nothing. So it could be that the market essentially just stops here and goes, you know what? We don't have a lot of conviction. You don't have a lot of conviction. Let's just idle. without a real lead from U.S. yields, tough to say that you couldn't have that happen and then nothing happens at all.
Dylan, I was looking at trade opportunities here. In the event of a bigger pullback, note that volatility is continuing to come in. For basically putting up a dollar to make a dollar, 57% probability of profit, the strikes may be a little bit wider than people would typically do, and this takes on a little bit more risk. But when you get down to that area where the BOJ looks like that they're, you know, they've drawn the line in the sand, if you have something that's 57% probability of profit, maybe it's a little bit lower than closer to 50% of the time, it feels like taking one of these swings is worthwhile, because then the way that you lose money in the market is if the BOJ Ministry of Finance allowed dollar yen to get through the 160.40 high. And at that point, it can become painful very quickly if you're not nimble and don't liquidate your position if the market does break through that region. But otherwise, if you see a deeper pullback with vol coming in long at the money, or even widen out the strikes like I have here on the call vertical, one of two ways to do it, plain and simple. But we got to wait. First moves are missed. Got to be patient.
Yeah, I mean, this is, in order for this to look like it's convincing, you'd need to have yields really start to follow through. And for the markets to go right, the Fed is not as hawkish as we all feared. And that's actually probably the most interesting bit here. The more I've been pondering sort of why indeed would one be bearish here? Has the fundamental narrative changed? And the most interesting part of it is the market is cheering what? Soft U.S. jobs data, really weak service sector data as well, the first contraction in the service sector since 2022. So what is it that we're happy about? If you look at what those numbers represent, they're not out of sorts with where things have been going. There's been now about 2 weeks, give or take, maybe a little bit more at this point, of a trend in U.S. economic data increasingly underperforming relative to forecasts. The PMIs kind of started it. They were impressively weaker than expected. And since then, it's been sort of weakness on weakness on weakness. Then you look at how global data has been performing. It's rolled over as well. Emerging markets, developed markets. You look at the PMI data, it's kind of rolling over. And you say, okay, yes, this means more Fed rate cuts. Sure. It also means maybe the global business cycle is turning, because all it's had to stand on was U.S. resilience for about a year and a half now. China hasn't been able to get off the mat and looks like it's not going to anytime soon anyway. And the euro area is limping, to say the least. So,
but I thought the
most, what exactly are we cheering?
Well, I mean, I thought that were the maybe the more most controversial, not that it's so controversial, but it could be. And most interesting thing that I've heard said in our discussion today was your suggestion, or I guess it was actually with Tom and Tony, but your suggestion, Ilya, that the market is now too hawkish and that there's going to be more cuts.
Yes.
The market expects. That would be,
yes,
the, in terms of going to your question of what are we cheering for?
Right.
Right. That there's now leverage in cuts that didn't exist because of everything that's gone on the last 2 months.
Right. And this sort of raises a really interesting question. If the reason we had the fourth quarter and first quarter rally was the economy is fine and there's cuts, which seemed like exactly what was going on, right? The economy wasn't falling off a cliff. It was doing fine. And the Fed was going to cut. That's a great narrative. That makes sense. Risk on. The degree to which, as we've learned, the Fed would cut as expected by markets relative to as announced by the Fed, that mattered. So when the markets became more or less hawkish than the markets, that turned out to be impactful. At this point, we're in a place where the market is more hawkish than the Fed, but the Fed has said enough things to think maybe there's alignment. And that's one way of reading it. But if in June, the Fed says three, again, and it's because and it's because they've been right this entire time, and the business cycle is turning, and the weakness is coming, and the disinflation is on the way, because the global economy is actually rolling over, then the whole makings of the rally are questionable, but for entirely different reasons. It's not that it's not that we're running the risk of the economy being fine and the Fed not cutting as much. That's ultimately a good thing. Chris has made this point, I think, very, very eloquently. If ultimately your problem is the money isn't cheaper because the economy is doing well, that's not the hardest pill to swallow. The hardest pill to swallow is if the economy isn't doing well and the central bank is still dragging its feet. And if the central bank is cutting, but it's cutting because things are going the wrong way, that's not good news. Markets don't like it, again, to Chris's point, when the actual cutting starts, because the cutting never happens because things are going well.
Yeah, maintenance cuts never turn out to be maintenance cuts.
Right? Yeah, yeah. There's no such thing as a maintenance cut, ultimately. If you're cutting, it's because something's gone awry.
Yeah, it's not like, you know, if getting the cuts are like going to the hospital, there's no like, this isn't just running to your physician for your annual checkup, so you get a rate cut to tune things up. That's not how it works. But Dylan, you know, so much of this story about what's happening with stocks here, you know, is it the resuscitation of these Fed rate cut odds? The earnings haven't been bad, plain and simple. I know that Tom said some of the reactions have been bad this week. Reddit just released, by the way. They had very good results. Share price last I saw was up 20% after hours. Where's my 1 minute chart? Let's slap a fiver on there. You got $56.70. You know, it's really, I'm kicking myself for this today. I had this hunch. Google changed their SEO site indexing a few months ago, and it's really hurt some companies and it's really helped others. Reddit was the number one company that benefited from Google site indexing changes. And they said, you know, maybe going into the earnings, they probably, and I didn't act on it. Granted, good results, but it's not been all bad is the point I'm getting at, Dylan.
No.
Apple perceived to have good earnings results the other day.
And yet
you seem to think that there's another story being told here. What's your problem with Apple and Tim Apple, friend?
Apple did not do anything because of earnings. Apple went up because of a gigundous buyback, which I don't even have a fundamental issue with buybacks or the idea that a company would want to distribute resources to its shareholders. But when you are the world's most respected innovator and technological growth company, and the most interesting thing you can come up with to do with your money is to pay dividends like Eastman Kodak or something from Xerox from 66. They blew it on the car, they blew it on AI. I just think that, you know, this is a longer term perspective, but I do think that it is not a good look for Apple to be, listen, the stock should be higher because of the buyback. Math is math, but it doesn't reflect well on management over the intermediate time frame, I guess I would say. Let me put it into some rational financials. The multiple should come in. The company's obviously not the growth company that everybody wants it to be. If their most interesting use of resources is to buy back the stock.
Right. It's one of the reasons why companies don't necessarily initiate dividends, because it signals that you don't necessarily, management doesn't necessarily feel that the best use of the incremental dollar is spent into R&D for the company.
Reflection on management's lack of ideas. Can you imagine Tesla doing a stock buyback? Elon Musk would be horrified.
Well, I mean, if Tesla came out right now and said, like, we're starting dividends, I think that'd be a horrible sign for shareholders.
Yeah.
Right.
And it would be an indication that of the whole reason people love Elon Musk is he's always got another, maybe a bad idea, but he's got another idea.
So, Dylan, what's the play here? We're at 182 and a half. We'll call it 182 and a half, right? 182.40 cents. It is $17 off the lows. It's about $17 off the highs. We are sitting directly in the middle of a range that's been here for a little while now. I know volatility is low, but is the play basically to say that Apple is going to be a stick in the mud, perhaps biased to the downside of the range? Even if the NASDAQ and the S&P continue to rally, it's going to be more of a Fab Five environment and less of a Magnificent Seven. You still have your terrible two in Apple and Tesla that aren't necessarily going to help for the cause. So you can be a bull in the NASDAQ.
I think Tesla is still an innovator. Is an idiot that bets against Apple just because of one red flag? But it's a red flag.
Apple had their new iPad Pro, iPad Air announcement, but they have one coming up in June, the Worldwide Developers Conference, June 10th to the 14th. They are expected to unveil a significant AI application at this developers conference. Now, for me, in my head, if I really wanted to get bullish on Apple, the bar is going to be they need to say that they have a new iPhone coming out with some very specific AI capability that will not work on any other version of the iPhone. Mm. I went from the 10 to 14 last year. I upgrade every 3 or 4 years. Just there's no reason to do so otherwise. It was a faster phone. The cameras were nicer. It's bigger. It's clunkier. I can do exactly the same thing my old phone did. There was no apps or features on it that I now use today that I wasn't using a year ago that I'm like, wow, what an improvement. The iPhone 14, life changer. Couldn't believe I didn't upgrade after the 10. That's what they need. They need something that differentiates their phone.
That either comes with an AI or a battery that lasts a week.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. That would be, then everybody would buy that iPhone. Everybody. But, you know, that's...
So, Dylan, interestingly enough, the developers conference is the 10th to the 14th. There is an option that expires here on the 7th. Probably not going to get paid much for this, but a short... And given the volatility here, short strangle, 200 and just to double check the levels down here, 164, call it 160. See, you can't really get paid on this because everyone's looking at the same exact thing right now. So you want to play this range. I guess you can, this is the exact opposite of a madman's light. This is picking up pennies in front of the steamroller. Profit of 35 against 460.
This is the other madman's light.
This is the whiskey sipper.
No, this is the person who's picking up cans and recycling them and collecting the 5 cents back. And right, like you could do this, I suppose. Is it worth tying up the buying capital for people? Probably not. But yeah, odds are that you'll do well in this trade because we probably don't break the year-long highs or lows before the developer conference. But again, is it worth the squeeze? Dylan, we mentioned this a few weeks ago.
The point is everybody's there because everybody's like, the stock's doing nothing until the developers conference.
It's going to go up. It's going to go down a little bit. It's Bob Barker. It's priced right.
It got remarked on the buyback, so now it's just going to trade around that whatever that number is, to $1.80 or something.
I mean, think about the action that you had all through March and April. Just imagine taking this and resetting it here. Just chop between like 190 and 175 for the next few weeks would make a ton of sense. So if you wanted to do something like that, maybe you scale in We can pinch this in a little bit more. 68% probability of profit. Max profit 99 against max loss of 401. That's a little bit better. Mm-hmm. Still not a ton. It's a little bit better. Let's put it on. Let's get something working here. Apple's not going to do anything. That's the bet for the next 5 weeks. Next 4 weeks, Apple doesn't do anything.
The most efficient way to do this is the Apple does this is the best Apple does nothing trade you've got.
The other side of it is, I think about this from a calendar perspective. Maybe the other side is buying the straddle for the 14th as well.
Now we're talking. I like this. This is a little more exciting anyway.
Getting it on the other side of the developer conference.
And get long that turkey. It's got to do something.
Max loss of 972. Something to chew on. You're paying for a little bit of the time premium now. So quite frankly, waiting a little bit longer and going into that week doing the at the money straddle, maybe that's the madman trade for that week around the developers conference.
It won't be 180. Whatever happens, it won't be 180.
Correct. And ideally it'll be back at 170 or back at 200. Ideally. But Dylan, I think we mentioned this.
I mean, just looking at the IV rank here, it doesn't look like the market is expecting a whole lot. So how much market movement are you going to get when the developer conference happens and there's not, and they don't announce that they can send a toaster to the moon with AI?
They can, and they will. Oh yeah,
the forever battery. And talk about the doomed, because it's talk about the efficient market theory. The depth and liquidity in Apple and the amount of coverage.
That's the thing.
I mean, to think that you could that it's not priced absolutely perfectly all the time.
Sure.
It's a difficult sell to say. The market looks at this now and expects this conference to do much of anything to really change the game. So you figure then the risk is that they actually announce something that the market goes, whoa, hold on. And if that's the risk, then maybe what you play for is the other side. But
well, then maybe
you just don't do anything.
To that point, that if the only outlier event is something innovative from Apple, which is sort of a sad thing to say.
Right.
In other words, the market's not expecting much from Apple. Even after the developers conference, the stock will still trade around 180 in this little story I'm telling. And the unexpected event is Chris's AI or my battery is in the deal and the stock moves up again. Another recent goes to 200. That's the outlier. And you can get yourself a cheap out of the money call on the madman side and see what happens.
And you want to play the madman here. It's the long 200, long 165 calls and puts respectively, right?
Yeah.
Because the market here, I mean, we have an episode at the end of February, beginning of March, when Apple announced that they were done with their EV. We're like, isn't this a sign that they're no longer an innovation leader? That they announced that they're switching their attention to Gen AI.
Scrap the car and then stack the buyback,
So yeah, the stock was chopping around between 165 and 180 after the beginning of March. And maybe we've just kicked the range higher because of the buybacks. But Dylan, I think you're right. I mean, unless they come out with something super innovative that changes the perception that they are now being pushed out of China and this is the huge problem for these companies right now. It's not just that they're getting pushed out of the Chinese market because of the Chinese domestic competition. The Chinese goods are now leaving the Chinese domestic market and are making their way into the rest of the world. We've heard from a number of countries, the United States included, Argentina, Brazil, Canada, European Union, UK, that China is basically flooding the market with overproduced cheap vehicles, electronic vehicles, cars, cell phones, what have you. Official complaints have been filed with the WTO, if I recall correctly, within the past month.
Yeah. Yellen even went over there and talked about it there and basically said, listen, dude, take it easy.
So So right now there's this whole notion that, yeah, you have these pristine brands that are American and Tesla and Apple, but at the end of the day, the average consumer worldwide does not care about brand.
They want and demand is waning. So
and demand's also coming off the board.
And demand is waning. So whatever you're going to get is going to be at the lower end. There's a trading down in sort of the average EV that's bought.
Right. People are getting more ground beef instead of steaks.
Sure. Sure.
So the substitution effect is in place as well. You need a cell phone. You're probably not going to go shell out $1,000 US for the latest iPhone. So they need something that innovates and makes those phones more in demand for high-end consumers. And they need to do something that makes the product cheaper for lower-end consumers. And they tried doing that years ago when they, I think it was around the time of the iPhone 6 or 5. They did those, you know, like they went into like the nano sizes for the iPods and smaller SEs, I think they were called, the standard edition phones. But now this is just dead in the water. So it's probably going to hold the next few weeks.
It'd be interesting for an activist to get him. I mean, this would be a great company for a big activist to come in and
hold just on. Start complaining. If Nelson Peltz, now granted, Disney had a terrible day today, but this has been on a very nice run from the lows in November. If Nelson Peltz couldn't get Bob Iger and Disney to change their ways after what was clearly a horrible run in their stock price over the past few years, why would Tim Apple think that his company needs to change their ways or even hear the ear of an activist investor when you look at how much money they're making still?
Yeah, I mean, the only reason is they've run out of ways to use their resources innovatively, or they claim to be an innovator. The same way Disney claims to be an entertainment company, and they're making horrible movies, and the stock's not, you know, it's better now, but as Disney had the horrible run they had, we don't have to review it. Apple claims to be the world's most innovative company, and the most innovative thing they can come up to do with their money is to buy back their own stock. It borders on pathetic. Even if it's financially rational, but it's not indicative of anything to do with growth or innovation.
Companies that, so your framework is when you see companies moving it into more buybacks?
No.
Increased dividends, they're less growth oriented?
I think it's context dependent. And I think if you are the world leader in innovation, it's one thing. If I'm not saying buybacks are universally a red flag, or that any that asset, that resource distribution is inherently a bad thing. But if your entire ethos is based on your status, rightly deserved, as the world's greatest and most innovative company, or certainly one of, and you're running a mega buyback, and you just blew it on the car, and you're nowhere on AI, and you're diddling around on marginal iPhone improvements,
right?
I mean, what is going on here?
Come right,
on.
And that's why with the new, you know, chips that they put into their iPads today, like, great, they're super fast, awesome, cool, marginal upgrade. It's just going fast. Yeah, it's faster, has more memory, it can do these things a little bit better, cooler. Mm-hmm. But like, what's the new product? Right, it's not Vision Pro.
And not only what's the new product, but it's don't you have something better to do with that money? Like, even like the Beats acquisition, which at the time I thought was preposterous with this pricing and all that, but it was risky and brilliant, and they were right. You know, it was, they did it, and it was a powerful thing to do. That's a move, right?
It seemed out of the box at the time, but it did pay off. That's for sure.
It's more of an Apple move.
I mean, they bought Nest as well, and that seemed like it was going to be something, but I'm not sure if anything got,
yeah, like made the Internet of Things narrative.
But Apple TV, widely panned, right? Yeah. And at this point, ubiquitous.
Yeah.
I mean, I have one. It's great.
Well, I see what you're saying, where, yeah, it's in terms of the adoption. Yeah.
Yeah.
The problem is, I don't have the comp. You know, it's one of those things where, like, in the future, I'll look back and be like, "Oh yeah, I was right." You know, Apple had stopped innovating, and the stock's been rotting for the last 3 years. 3 years from now, but I have zero confidence to bet against the company because of the ethos is innovation, and I still think there's a reasonable chance they'll come up with something that's fantastic.
Well, we'll have to figure that out tomorrow, because now for this Tuesday, overtime is out of time. We'll be back on Wednesday, same time, same place, here on Tasty Live every Monday through Thursday, 4 p.m. Eastern, 3 Central, after Last Call. For the man in blue, Dylan Radigan, and the man in orange, Julia Spivak, I've been Chris Vecchio. Good luck trading. See you tomorrow. Up next, after a brief break, more Tasty Live with Ilya Spivak and Macro Money.
See you there, everybody.
The content of this podcast is created, produced, and provided solely by Tasty Live, Inc. and does not represent the direct views or opinions of any of its affiliated companies. This content is for informational and educational purposes only. It is not, nor is it intended to be, trading or investment advice or a recommendation that any security, futures contract, digital asset, other product, transaction, or investment strategy is suitable for any person. Trading securities, futures products, and digital assets involve risk and may result in a loss greater than the original amount invested. Tasty Live, Inc., through its content, financial programming, or otherwise, does not provide investment or financial advice or make investment recommendations. The information provided may not be appropriate for all investors and is provided without respect to individual investor financial sophistication, financial situation, investing time horizon, or risk tolerance. Tasty Live, Inc. is not a licensed financial advisor, registered investment advisor, registered broker-dealer, or registered